Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. It's holiday season. We are in it. It is Christmas Eve, everybody. Maybe you're enjoying a cup of something warm by a fire, or you're out and about doing some last-minute shopping, or maybe you're preparing for a holiday feast, or maybe you're one of those people who gets ahead of themselves and they're preparing for a New Year's Eve party. Who are you people? On today's show, we're talking about how to prepare the perfect holiday meal with food and travel journalist, cookbook author, recipe magician, and executive editor at Savoir Magazine, Stacey Adamando. Hi, Stacey.
Hi.
So Savoir focuses on traditions as opposed to sort of food trends, like not a whole lot of foam.
Yeah. We like to do the stuff that's classic and it'll stay around and you could use forever, not kind of the flash in the pan trends. So the types of recipes on our site are things that we feel like, you know, kind of don't go out of date.
All right. So it's holiday season. Your guests show up. It's cocktail hour.
You know where to start.
Do I give folks when they walk in the door?
Okay. Well, first of all, because you want to have something ready for folks when they walk in the door, you want to pre-batch, right? So you don't want to be mixing a cocktail per guest or asking them, which one would you like? So I like to have big batches of things. So get a huge mason jar or a pitcher, anything you have. Mix up something that is one of your festive holiday favorites. You could do eggnog. You could do a bourbon punch. Actually, in my family, we do margaritas. Anything goes, you know.
I'll be over.
Yeah. So that gets everybody at ease. That gets you at ease. You have something to put in their hand when they walk in the door. And then from there on, the pressure's off.
My holiday cocktail is a poinsettia. Do you know this?
Ooh, you know, I've heard of that, but I don't even think I've ever had one. What goes into that?
Sparkling wine.
Okay. Oh, I love
cranberry.
Yep.
A little Cointreau.
Ooh.
So it's beautiful color.
I was going to say, it sounds very festive looking, too.
Great ruby. Uh-huh. And then you can get schnockered. Everybody's pretty festive after a couple of those.
Perfect.
Eggnog. A lot of people, it's a divisive issue. It's a divisive issue, eggnog.
It is.
How do you feel about it?
I'm okay for a few sips, but I might maybe abandon my glass after that. You know, it's a one drink kind of a drink for me.
Is there a simple way to make it? Because I think it seems a little bit...
Yeah, I mean, it's really not that involved. And in fact, we have a recipe on our site for aged eggnog, which sounds really terrifying, but the flavors really marry as it ages. And it actually makes it a little bit more safe to drink because, you know, it's raw egg that's going into there. But when the egg sits a little while, it has a little time to cure. So they say that actually makes it a little bit, like, safer. I mean, not that it's unsafe, but if you have a concern about that, that might make you feel a little bit better.
So, oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, you can get it done ahead.
How about a hot toddy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, you know, and the house is going to, I mean, my thing with hot drinks is the house is going to fill up. So you got to kind of, you know, keep the temperature at a level where you're not giving guests, you know, they're wearing their Christmas sweaters or something. You're giving them a hot drink. I mean, I get boiling hot when I'm hosting personally. So I'm running around. Hot drinks, it's like you got to know if that's the right crowd and the right temperature for you. But I think it's beautiful because they make the whole house smell good. So they sit on the stove and you have to keep them warm and they've got, you know, cinnamon or anise in there or something. And all of a sudden, like the whole house is perfumed with your cocktail. So that's, you know, if that's your thing, I mean, it's fun.
I like that idea. That idea that it creates an ambiance through.
Yeah.
Through the smell of it
yeah.
all.
Yeah, alcohol kind of always creates ambiance, though, doesn't it?
True. And other things. You and your family are big antipasti people.
Oh, yes. So, I mean, my philosophy when hosting is if you're going to have multiple courses, you go a little bit light on antipasti. But if you don't feel like making a bunch of courses, you load up on antipasti, and that just really impresses people. I mean, if you think about it, first impression is always the most important thing, right? So it's the first food they're going to see from you. You know, if you have the basic stuff, olives and cheese and charcuterie, sure, that's great. But if you even do one thing above and beyond that, it's remarkable, right? Because that's what everybody falls back on. So, I mean, I actually am so enamored with this. It's my new book. My book is coming out in the spring, and it's all about antipasti. It's called Piatti. But the concept is, just like the Italians do, they leave things out at room temperature. So you pick food that can just sit out, and it actually tastes just as good, whether it's, you know, warm or not. And, you know, people can kind of graze on it as they pass by, as they have their drink. You're not serving them a special plate. You're not having more dishes to wash. So antipasti is kind of like a good go-to if you're a little bit less, you know, secure about the feeling of the rest of the meal, or you don't want to cook multiple courses, I say start big on the antipasti in that case.
I have a very basic question. What has to be on that plate for it to be considered antipasti?
Well, that is the perfect question that you asked, because nothing has to be on there, first of all. So antipasti just means before the meal. There are like almost no rules to it. In fact, I mean, from Italy, you know, where it comes from, the concept is that it's abundant and inexpensive ingredients. So they do a lot of vegetables, they do some grains, even some room temperature fish and meat if it's an inexpensive cut. So you can do, you know, bread type antipasti. Have you ever heard of the 6 foot sub?
Sure.
I do like a micro version of the 6 foot sub. So I split a baguette down the center and then fill that up with all the charcuterie and chopped olives and all the same stuff, the cheese that would go on your antipasti board. But instead, it's on this delicious crispy baguette, and you cut that up into small pieces and people can eat it kind of like crostini. And it's so good, and it looks really cool down the center of the table because it's a huge baguette lined with delicious, colorful things. So stuff like that. It's like one thought that goes a little bit above and beyond the classic. If you warm up your olives before you serve them, like I do a little drizzle of olive oil, I'll do like a maybe even some little mandarin segments or some orange wedges or something, and toss that in a pan, and then it comes out piping hot, and people are like, oh my God, this is so great and so different, but it's olives.
You had me at baguette.
Yeah.
We're talking to Stacey Adamondo, executive editor of Savour magazine. Goat cheese is always a favorite, but then sometimes when you put the log out there, it's like, that just looks like a log of a log.
Well, and it's even sadder, like as it sits and people start scraping away at it, it kind of gets all smushy. But my trick, so I slice the rounds, I slice the goat cheese into rounds, and you put those rounds on a plate, and then you drizzle on top like some sort of like savory salsa that you could make with whatever you have in your fridge. So chopped walnuts, chopped olives, chopped herbs, mix that in with olive oil and just drizzle it all over the top of the goat cheese. So it looks like this gorgeous, you know, elaborate dish that you've done, but it's goat cheese from the supermarket. And you serve that with crusty bread for dipping in it. And it's like everybody's favorite thing.
And then it also, it stays looking lovely.
It's
as
beautiful.
Opposed to
yeah.
A,
yeah. I mean, even it kind of like looks more festive as you dig in and sort of the little rounds start to disappear and, you know, the oil gets lapped up. It's delicious.
My go-to with it is a piece of sliced bread, a round of goat cheese, honey, and coarse pepper.
Ooh,
and stick it in
yes.
the oven for just a second.
The pepper is everything there. That is a good call.
That's a crowd pleaser,
yeah,
I will tell you.
Sounds great.
I see here that you recommend soup, but that scares me, the idea of soup at a party. I have to be honest.
Okay, so the thought here, I mean, again, if, you know, it's the holidays, if there's any meal that you're going to do more than one course, it's going to be a holiday meal, right? But soup, if you especially go with a pureed soup, you can do this like 3 days in advance. Throw it into a blender, put the blender pot in the refrigerator, and when your guests show up, you heat it up, and that's it. And literally anything that you have in your pantry can dress this up so that the bowls look really elegant. So you can do pumpkin seeds on top, chopped nuts. Sometimes I drizzle like maple syrup or honey if it's like a carrot soup or sweet potato soup or something. Even olive oil, store-bought croutons. I mean, anything goes on top of that and makes it look like $1 million. So I'm a fan of that as like if you want to shove something else at them course-wise, you could do that and it's like not even breaking a sweat.
And also the preparing ahead. You got me on that one
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Let's talk main courses. Okay, vegetarians, I'm sorry. We're going to talk about cooking lamb because it is traditional in
yeah,
many
yeah.
households. The classic recipes calls for, you know, frenching the meat. Is that aesthetics or does that actually do something?
You know, I think it's aesthetics. It's old school. Yeah. And if you want something like that to make it look really clean on the bones, have your butcher do that. Do not do that at home. That is a waste of time. Yeah.
What about chicken cacciatore? A lot of Ooh. Italian households.
Okay. See, I appreciate this because sometimes I think the oven gets really crowded during a holiday meal or any big meal when you're hosting. So you're roasting vegetables, you're heating up the bread, and you have a roast in. And all of a sudden, things need to be at different temperatures and you're getting freaked out. Something's going to overcook and something's not going to be done yet. So I love the idea of a meat that goes on the stovetop, like a braise. Chicken is a perfect example. Everybody loves it. You're going to get some of your vegetable in there, so you don't even really need too much of a side dish with that. That's a really nice idea.
So if I had to have a side dish, though, can you give me a few ideas that just aren't the thing we usually see, something unusual, something that might have a little bit of a wow.
Now, are you talking a side dish for chicken cacciatore?
Just for anything.
Okay, because that's very specific. For anything, okay, so my rule of thumb is you go with something that's hot and something that's cold and crisp. So cold and crisp, of course, you think of a salad, but a salad doesn't have to be lettuce. It can be a shaved vegetable. I love fennel. Fennel is one of my favorites. Of course, we're Italian-American, but you know, you could do shaved carrots, even just, you know, like raw peppers, shaved beets, something like that. And that could be the base of your salad. So that gives you that kind of cooling, refreshing bite that's separate from the meat and a little contrast to the meat. And then something warm. I think roasted vegetables is an obvious, very easy go-to. You can do almost any vegetable, cut them all the same size, spread them out, olive oil, salt, pepper. But I think something that people don't expect is sometimes even like boiling a vegetable. Sounds so granny and old school, but one of my favorite antipasti type dishes, and I also serve this as a side dish, is boiled colorful beets. So I take golden beets, pink beets, red beets, boil them, and you don't have to take up any oven room. Throw a little salt in the boiling water. That's it. And then you chop them into wedges, and you can serve them with like a pesto, an aioli, something that's just like a drizzleable, delicious little, you know, easy sauce. And that is so colorful on the plate, and it's not a potato, you know, like everybody thinks of potato and they want to fill something up or have a side dish, but a beet is like the upscale potato.
And the colors. I mean, what
so
a presentation,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We're talking to Stacey Adamando, executive editor of Savoir Magazine. All right, we got to dessert. We're towards the end. Sweets, do you want something elaborate at the holiday season, simple?
It depends. I mean, okay, you know, I'm a baker, of course. You know, if you're not a food professional, you might be like, oh, well, it's not so easy for everybody. Although I truly believe that there's a dormant baker in all of us and you just need a good teacher. So if you want to go elaborate, I say do one elaborate thing. Don't do five elaborate things. Have guests bring cookies and small objects, and then you just make, you know, one great tart or one great cake or something that can be the centerpiece of the table. If you're going to go a little bit more basic, maybe do two really easy things. So, you know, one trick I really do this all the time is buy a store-bought brownie mix and swirl into it something delicious like either peanut butter. I do sesame tahini, which is so delicious and like nutty. Yeah. It's so different and unexpected. Or you can even make your own nut butter. Like sometimes I do like pistachio butter and swirl that into brownies. Yes. And throw a little hint of sea salt on the top of that. And like as old as that trick is, it works every time. It's so great.
My favorite thing on the list of things in front of me for dessert is slab pie.
Oh, yes. So, I mean, I'm a big, don't say that as its name, maybe, because it doesn't sound so elegant, but
it's the greatest
slab
name ever.
Anything slab is like pie. The most genius cheat. Okay, so think about cookies. Like, you're worried they're not going to all come out the same. You know, with a pie, it's so finicky. Is the bottom crust going to cook? Yada, yada. Slab is basically a shorthand for spread out in a big baking sheet. So you put the pie dough or the cookie dough all across the big bottom of the baking sheet, and then you put the fillings on top or any chocolate chips or anything you want to add. And then, you know, if you're making a pie, put the top crust on, and you just bake that almost like a Pop-Tart. And it's like so much quicker to cook because you don't have to cook through that whole thick center, and you can cut it into squares and people can eat it with their fingers, and you throw some ice cream on the side of that, and it's like so cool and different, and you get that flaky crust just like you would with a regular pie.
I love that. I'm going to try that.
Yeah.
I truly am. Do you have a family tradition that you do for the holidays, something that's really special food-wise?
We do. You know, one thing that is traditional on all of our holidays, and it seems so funny sometimes when guests come in that aren't Italian-American, is we do a stuffed pasta. So, you know, we'll have maybe lasagna with homemade noodles, and we put tiny meatballs in the inside, or we'll do homemade manicotti or ravioli. And I think, you know, I actually wrote a piece for this on Savoir.com this year, thinking like, you don't have to be Italian to do this, but it's one of the funnest traditions, and it is something that you can do ahead, throw in the freezer, just the raw uncooked pasta, and then put a pot of boiling water on and throw the pasta in. But it makes the house smell so good, like having sauce on the stove. And it's another bite that will fill people up. So maybe you don't have to spend as much money on the expensive meat and vegetables. So it kind of serves a number of purposes and also just becomes a tradition to look forward to, you know, and it helps you kind of just feel like you overdid it in a good way on the holiday.
And I like that idea of food being tradition.
Yeah.
In a family. And yeah. You can make new traditions every year.
Totally, totally. We look forward to that, doing that together and standing around the kitchen with, you know, flowery aprons on. And it's a really good time.
Stacey Adamondo, executive editor of Savour Magazine, thank you for being with us, and
Merry Christmas. Thank you so much. Merry Christmas to you all.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. We'll be right back. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. It's Monday afternoon, which means it's time on All of It when we check in with our regular contributor, friend of the show, Clemency Burton Hill. Clemmy is WNYC's creative director for music and arts, and she stops by our studio once a week to play us some of the classical music tracks that made it into her book, Year of Wonder, Classical Music to Enjoy Day by Day. And this is an extra special visit because it is Christmas Eve. And to mark the occasion, Clemmy has brought us some music to get us in the spirit. Hi, Clemmy.
Hi. Merry Christmas Eve.
Merry Christmas Eve
is
to you.
Is that a thing?
It is now. Between you and me, it is. Between us.
I just feel like we had to go full on Christmassy today. So I've started with a setting of a Christmas carol by John Rutter, who's a British composer, and I think we can legitimately dub him the King of Christmas. You almost certainly, whether you know it or not, have been hearing some of his music piping out through the shopping malls and through the pizza restaurants and wherever you've been doing your Christmas shopping, if indeed you have been, if you haven't left it all too late and doing it this afternoon. His take on Christmas is just so magical, and he intrigues me as a composer because a lot of his music sounds incredibly simple. I don't mean simplistic, but it's sort of straightforward and it's simple and it's very accessible in the best possible way. And yet when you dig a little deeper, what he does is actually quite complex, but he just seems to absolutely nail the spirit of Christmas. And he is often associated with Cambridge, where he's been living for a very long time, and he writes a lot for the choir of King's College, Cambridge, who are a busy band at this time of year.
I can imagine, yes.
You can imagine. They have their legendary annual ceremony of 9 lessons and carols that's broadcast every year from King's College Chapel all around the globe, including here in the US. He was commissioned to write this carol for, I think it was the 1998 service of 9 lessons and carols. So it's been around for a while. It's a setting of a 17th century Christmas carol by the poet Robert Herrick, and it's called What Sweeter Music.
Let's listen. Those sweet little, I picture little boys with the white collars.
Oh, yeah.
And their books out, their hymnals out.
And that very earnest expression on their face. I know, and the older singer's probably a little bit hungover from the night before. I was at Cambridge University. I know what goes on. But no, absolutely heavenly music. And I like the fact that, yes, I joked that you could well be doing your Christmas shopping in a mad dash this afternoon. What I should have said was, I will be doing my Christmas shopping in a mad dash this afternoon. This is a judgment-free zone. I always leave it to the last minute. But I do like the fact that whatever your background is, whether you are a believer or not, that does make you think about the gifts that we can bring in the fullest possible sense of that word. And I just think Rutter is an absolute genius when it comes to writing Christmas music. So,
your entry for the 24th of December is Wagner.
It is. Now, he's a divisive figure in the history of music, and you wouldn't necessarily associate him with Christmas. But his beloved wife, Cosima, was born on Christmas Eve on this very day. And there's a moment that really kind of stops me in my tracks. She was apparently lying in her bed on Christmas in December 1870 and was gradually waking up and coming round to consciousness with the strains of this extraordinarily beautiful music floating up the stairs in her house towards her. And what Richard Wagner had done, and he was by all accounts a pretty romantic guy, even if some of his other thinkings about the world leave a little to be desired. He was clearly a besotted husband and deeply loved his wife, and he had written this piece for her and got a band of local musicians to come into their house and actually play it live. So you didn't have Spotify in those days. You couldn't just switch on your CD. You couldn't choose your Pandora. It was, you know, it had to be played by real human beings. And she did say in her diary, "As I awoke, my ear caught a sound which swelled fuller and fuller. No longer could I imagine myself to be dreaming. Music was sounding, and such music."
So was the song her Christmas/birthday gift?
I guess it was. You'd be pretty happy with it, wouldn't you? It was definitely also a celebration of their family. She'd given birth to their first son, who was called Siegfried, or Fidi, the previous year. This was her birthday. I think he was filling his score with the tenderest of personal musical references to them. The official title is actually Tribschen Idyll. Tribschen was where they lived, with Fidi's bird song and the orange sunrise as symphonic birthday greeting presented to his Cosima by her Richard. And he was very distressed that he later had to sell this piece of music to a publisher because he didn't have enough money. And I think that he really wanted it to remain a private love letter in a way between the two of them. But it got published, and then it was later incorporated into his opera Siegfried, and it's now known as the Siegfried Idyll. But initially it started off as that very personal gesture between a husband and his wife.
We're on to Christmas Day, since we're almost there.
Almost there.
Bach.
Bach. It had to be Bach for Christmas Day. And when I was writing this book, I could have really filled Bach throughout the year, and I tried to restrain myself. January the 1st in Year of Wonder is also by Bach, and I do have Bach cropping up through the year. But this is a piece called the Christmas Oratorio, and it felt fitting for the 25th of December because the first ever performance of this particular piece took place at St. Nicholas's Church, of all things, in Leipzig on Christmas Day in 1734. And it's just unbelievably joyful, I think, Alison. He dizzyingly, joyously calls to celebrate, rejoice, rise up and praise these days. That's what the German means, jauchzet, frohlocket.
You in the spirit. If you don't have the spirit yet, I'm hoping it was just infused in you.
Exactly. Rejoice indeed. You know, whatever is going on in your life on the 25th of December, hopefully that will have put you in the mood to rejoice.
The name of the book is Year of Wonder, Classical Music to Enjoy Day by Day. Clemency Burton Hill, thank you for coming by as always, and Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas, Alison. Thank you.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and this is our special holiday theme show. We're very happy to have you here with us. In this show, we've been talking about food, tradition, music, cocktails, and of course, family. Our next guests are the owners of a beloved New York institution that combines all of those elements in one. In fact, it's such a family affair that the restaurant is named after their grandparents. It's Jack's wife, Frida. With three Manhattan locations, one in Soho, the West Village, and now in Chelsea, their signature family dishes include shakshuka, challah toast, and a matzo ball soup where the matzo ball is the size of your head. I exaggerate a little bit. And if you need a place to go on Christmas and New Year's, Jack's wife, Frida, their doors are open and they love to have you be part of their family. Dean and Maya, welcome to All of It.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi.
So, Dean, what inspired you to name the restaurant after your grandparents?
We started off, we knew we wanted to have a personality inside of the restaurant, and we went through multiple different names. One day, we were just kind of just sitting around hanging out, and we joked about it. How about Jack's wife, Frida? And we laughed, and we laughed, and we laughed some more, and pretty much we stuck with it. People initially had, when we told them the name, they pulled faces at us, and we couldn't pronounce it, Jack's wife, da, da. But once we got through it, it worked. And once you see the image and the sign, it's kind of the name. If you get it, you got it forever. If you don't get it, you miss it anyway.
Can you describe Jack and Frida?
Well, Jack, the name falls more onto Frida, her warmth, her hospitality, but it was their household. Jack happened to be the husband. So Frida was
along
this,
for the ride.
Yeah, she was just the most amazing, gracious grandmother, host, family, friend. She entertained probably 7 days a week. Jack spent a lot of time playing cards with his friends in like a back room or watching a lot of TV. And Frida was around everywhere. She'll touch everything. She had sweets out. She had bowls out. She had plentiful of food. She waited to space the table for many more people. And it was just this love and warmth as soon as you moved into a house that you felt protected, that you felt that you're somewhere special. And she provided all those treats for the kids and the grandkids and so on and so forth. So the idea was this woman, this really strong-willed, beautiful woman who would enter a home and they would have this delight around you.
It's interesting you should mention about being host and warm, because we've been talking about the holidays and families a lot. We've had people in from Bon Appetit and from Savour, how to make a great holiday get-together where everybody in the family feels welcome. And that's one of the things I really like about your restaurant. I'm a fan. I'm just going to be full disclosure. When you thought about creating this restaurant and creating this sort of inviting place, what kind of conversations did you have, Maya?
I think we, you know, living in the city from the late 90s, Dean and myself, respectively, until we met. We always worked in restaurants, and we just loved it. And I think we just got it, and we understood the typical New Yorker who needs to eat out and needs to have that extension of their living room or their apartment, because most of us are in smaller apartments. But just that feeling that you're in the right place, that feeling that you can go into a restaurant and whether you want to have a cup of coffee or breakfast or a three-course meal or bring your parents or have a date, that you have that spot. And we knew how to help people feel that welcoming, belonging feeling. And I think that's the magic. You know, the food is just a bonus, and we really believe in that feeling that everyone's welcome and everyone can get in and everyone can sit and there's place for everyone and it doesn't matter who you are.
You mentioned as long as you two have known each other. How did you guys meet?
In a restaurant.
In a restaurant.
Yeah, we're working at Baltazar together. I was the maitre d'. I was a breakfast waiter. I had to wear a button-up shirt and a tie. I was terribly uncomfortable. It was 6 o'clock in the morning, but I saw Maya, and I fell in love with her the moment I saw her. Mm. It took her a few more months to come around. But we used to run out the restaurant, have a secret cigarette together, run back into the restaurant, flirt a little. And that's how love ignites. It was very cute and very sincere. And
yeah, it was
romantic.
It was. He was very clumsy those first few weeks.
Purposefully clumsy, because your emotions get the best of you when you're around something you love.
People are thinking, where is that accent from? Where are you from?
So I'm from Johannesburg originally. I've been in New York 20 plus years. I've been in the States about 25 years now. But always working, you know, both of us always working in restaurants. Mm. And we love hosting. Even when at home, when we have people, we want to be the host. We don't enjoy going out and have other people sit and serve us type thing. We really like running around and making sure people are happy.
And I know one of the sort of the themes and sort of the ethos of the restaurant and the menu is that home cooking, like this idea of this is home away from home. So when you were putting together your menu, Tell me about the conversations you had about what you wanted and how you wanted to make sure it was unique to your restaurant.
Yeah, so I think everything, what makes a restaurant unique is that everything is that personal and everything does personally mean something to us. And when we were talking about the menu, it wasn't an initial thought. We didn't realize this until we stumbled upon meeting a few chefs trying to build a menu for us, and it just didn't feel, what's the word?
Yeah, we had multiple chefs show up with their food and plating their food their way, and it wasn't familiar to us. It wasn't something we enjoyed or wanted to pick apart.
It didn't feel sincere. And then it hit us, and we realized, let's put a list together of the things we love to eat, of the things that remind us of home, of the things that Frida was making, or my grandparents were making, or my mom was making, things that we had when we were sitting over our first date or when we had our honeymoon in Paris having croque madames. And then we kind of took all these classic memories but tried to find versions of them that make them special to us.
So in reviews, they describe it as global Jewish comfort food. What falls under that category?
Well, to start with, we have a matzah ball soup, which definitely falls into that Jewish genre. But also, being part of the city, we feel like matzah ball soup, you can get it at a bodega, you can get it at a deli, you can get it at a 4-star restaurant. That's definitely a New York dish, but it definitely has that sentiment of home or grandma. That's the same with the shakshuka, which is a great to pronounce and really interesting on the menu. Maya's grandmother would make shakshuka, you know, every weekend or whatever the case may be. So we took the shakshuka and we revised it initially from the red. We saw a green shakshuka and we were like, how can we make it green and make it a little more interesting? So that global grandma feeling comes in through those type of things. We have a chicken schnitzel, which is all our kids eat all the time. That's something you walk into any home in Israel, it smells like schnitzel all the time. So it's on the senses, it's on the plate, and it tastes delicious too.
And you lived in Israel, right, Maya?
Yeah, I lived there. I moved to Israel when I was 8, and I came back after my army service when I was 21.
Your sons cook with you?
Sometimes. The older one, the 11-year-old, is enjoying baking now, not cooking. And the little one will help a little. They're not super passionate. They do love... one of them is really interested in what happens in the back of the house, how we're getting everything fixed, how we're repairing the dishwasher. And the little one, who's 7, loves, and everyone who works in the restaurant knows this, that he just, you know, he'll pull up a chair, he'll take orders, he'll stand on the, you know, the POS system where you enter the orders, and he's on the floor doing the whole thing. And he was promoted from busboy to waiter, and he thinks he's a manager now. That's very cute.
Yeah. I like the whole family thing.
Yeah.
We're speaking to Dean and Maya Jenkelowitz,
mm-hmm.
from Jack's Wife Frida. I was close.
You did it.
You guys love to be hosts, and we've had a lot of people on talking about what's the thing they like to do when they host people in their home because of the holidays, when they throw parties. Can you offer some advice for people?
Yeah, the main thing and the most important thing, I feel, is keep their glasses full. If you walk around with a bottle in each hand and people have their glass and the glass are full, they're going to have a lot more time. I always find it interesting at work or at home or at other places, it takes like people an hour or hour and a half to kind of get comfortable with each other. So you want to bring that comfort level right away. And fortunately, unfortunately, however you want to look at it, filling people's drinks, bring them together quicker, a lot sooner than anything else. Mm-hmm. Definitely some nibbly food on the side also. But it's, you know, running around and connecting people, pouring someone a drink, and then you can introduce people, talk people over something. That's a very comforting thing to most people, to have something in their hand, something preferably full in the hand, pour it down, and it's filled up again. They're not looking, they're not shuffling, they got something right in front of them.
Mm. What are some of your hosting tips, Maya?
I mean, I think we have a pretty similar style. Mm-hmm. Dean will often, when he's on the floor, or you know, he'll be the one filling shots or cocktails, and I will be there filling nana teas. The idea is the same, to make sure everybody's, you know, mingling or talking to each other, breaking the ice. And you know, people do have those hard. It unfortunately does take sometimes an hour or so to break that ice. So just helping them find that comfort as quick as you can. But yeah, his style is a little more on the alcoholic side, and I love getting fresh mint teas for everyone. And
well, I think just at a party at home or wherever you are, like, involve people, get them engaged in it, not leave him, where's the bar, where do I stand, where do I sit, but really bringing people into that circle or the center of the onion, and then expressing your expression, whether it's tea or alcohol or snack, but bringing people around each other, not separating them of you're over there and where's the bathroom over there, but having that comfort in a party.
It's also interesting, in your restaurants, you have those communal tables. Mm. What have you seen develop out of the communal tables?
A lot.
Everything.
Everything.
I mean, love them, hate them. People absolutely love them. I don't know if they like sitting on top of each other or whatever the case
is. They don't like to admit that they love sitting on top of each other. But I think so. If we, when you examine the whole psychology of what happens when people are on top of each other, I think they like it because they do come back for more. And,
right.
And, you know, you eavesdrop, you hear, you make friends with the person next to you, you complain and you ask to move. You know, it all happens. On the communal, you get bumped. People ask for a real table, quote unquote. But it's kind of fun because people are forced to be out of their comfort zone for a moment. But if we know that our team is there to make sure they're okay being out of their comfort zone, they surprise themselves like, oh, it wasn't too bad.
Have you ever had any relationships blossom that you know of?
Oh, Dina's a very good matchmaker.
you're a matchmaker?
Yeah, maybe not at the communal, but as such. But it's the same thing, you know, reaching over somebody to get the sugar or the salt or a condiment or looking at someone's plate is a great point that people can have a conversation about something. And those little sparks of conversation, you can introduce people. But I've always enjoyed when people come to the bar or the communal, just actually, you know, off the cuff, introducing them in the most awkward way. And then they kind of left there to linger, whether it's the bar or at the table, and either connect or not connect. But for the most part, in the city especially, people want to connect. They want to be part of something. And what we like in Jack's Wife Frida, initially when we opened, which we still feel strongly about, you want to sit in a room of like-minded people or people that you, like you say, you see on the street or see in a neighborhood, and you kind of can connect with them with your eyes or your body language before actually having a conversation. But when you feel that energy in the room, it's really easy to connect the dots and, you know, pass over the salt or move the sugar over or say, oh, this got you a drink, this girl got you a drink, this guy got you a drink.
Yeah.
Just having fun with it. It's not supposed to be so dramatic and so serious. It's supposed to be very casual and very easy. And the best connections are made in the restaurant or through this casual ability to have a free conversation. And if you're looking for somebody out there, come into Jack's Bar for you.
Sit at the communal table.
We'll squeeze on the communal table.
Dean will do a little matchmaking for you.
We'll do something. We'll do something.
I do want to ask a business question. Your enterprise is a little bit like, there's a couple of local, and chain isn't the right word, but multiple locations. Like Grey Dog is one. Meatball Shop started off one, and they spread around the city. You are up to three locations, and I'll share you moved into my neighborhood, and I was furious that this old Mexican restaurant went out of business until I found out it was you guys. Aww. I felt good about that. I was very excited about that. What does it take to do that in New York City in these days, to do what you guys have done with Grey Dog, what Meatball Shop has been able to do, Westville.
Yeah, I mean,
you hand it.
Yeah, we don't think of it like you're saying, growing a chain or growing whatever, but it's like sharing your brand and sharing your people. And we work with a lot of amazing people. And you know, our inspiration was working in a restaurant, was working for somebody really amazing. And you want to grow and you want people to grow and you want the staff around you to grow. And then you start, you know, you start with the first place, which was the most incredible journey. And after a couple of years, you're like, how do we keep moving this along? And then you look at this logo of Frida and you look at the food and you look at, you know, we're serving 400 or 500 people a day, and it feels amazing. It's very uplifting for ourselves, for the staff and for the community. So going on to the second place was kind of like, how do we grow from 1 to 2? Absolutely nervous. Move into the second place and you get the same response from people. So then it becomes, you know, the first place was definitely, you know, we wanted to do it, you know, for us to open up a business and do something that we could share our love and our sense of hospitality, and then into the second place. And as we recently opened Chelsea, you realize you're doing something also for a greater. You're doing it for a community and you're doing it for a staff, and the well-being of the business, the well-being of us exists around all of that. So the reason for growth is to keep this well-being in check all the time. You know, if we stayed at Lafayette in the same store all the time, you would have the same little micro problems all the time. You need other people to figure out those problems. And then onto the next problem or the next space, everybody kind of takes shape. So it's that joy. It's the love of the game, actually, that you want to keep developing it. It's not a business model of let's open this or let's open this. It's more of how do we keep moving our life forward? How do we keep moving our community's life forward? And definitely how do we keep the staff engaged all the time, that they feel like we're part of something that has life inside of it all the time?
I also think there's a brand that is Jack's wife, Frida. And that's almost, it's almost too crass a word. And I don't mean it in the crass way. It's, but there's a sense of, there's a sensibility. There's a feeling you get when you come in. What did you do to develop that, Maya?
I think when we opened Lafayette, we, you know, it took everything we had.
Everything
we had. And I really believe that all that energy that we put in, and you know, sometimes we joke with the staff when we leave them on a really busy shift, we leave this like magic dust and we put it in their pocket and we let them use it later. And we, you know, all that energy and all these present moment decisions that we made almost 7 years ago when we opened that first place in Soho, I think it was over a year that we didn't have a day off and we worked 7 days a week, day into night. And we really gave it our hearts. And it's kind of like watching a baby grow up. You know, when you have a baby, you are nursing your baby. And, you know, at some point, I was personally with my baby attached to him when he was born for over a year. And then, okay, I can get a bottle and find a babysitter. So you just let go very, very slowly. And you're not holding on because you're micromanaging, but you really are aware of how it's growing. And it was really hard at the beginning. Nobody came. It was quiet. There were a lot of days like that. But we never let it get to us. Even if it was quiet and nobody was coming in, we still treated the one or two or three people that came in like they were everything, and they were everything. So all that energy, and, you know, we definitely believe in the whole spiritual part of the business, that energy is still there. And I think that's how we're able to keep growing, because all that energy we had 7 years ago, it's just...
Yeah, well, energy creates energy. Mm-hmm. And like we tell everyone all the time, like move around the floor, do something, turn the espresso machine on, open a bottle of wine. Just create this flow all the time that we're doing something. And it's felt. I feel it's felt. Because I going onto the brand, I feel like you do step into the room and it does feel special. And it feels special because we chose the tiles, you know, by ourselves, the chairs, the ceilings, the lights. Every staff member we interview about by ourselves, we train them, we put all this... thought into everything that goes into the operation every day. It's no coincidence that you walk inside that somebody, whether if I'm not there or Maya's not there, but they'll have that same attitude or that same fortitude when they're looking at a customer and saying, oh, this is the place I want to be in.
We're talking to Dean and Maya Jankelowitz of Jack's Wife Frida. It's holiday season. What do you guys do special for holiday season? You're open on Christmas and New Year's? Is that true?
We're just open. That's we don't do anything special, but we're open and we find that special, I think, because we don't have family in the city, and all of our years in the city over the holidays, we would have to go eat in a restaurant and we would find special places that made us feel like home. So we're able to provide that. And it's probably our busiest day, Christmas Day, at our Soho location only. We're open on Christmas Day. But it's the busiest day, and there's people who aren't celebrating, so at least they have a place to go to. People who are celebrating and don't want to be in their houses and want to entertain in a restaurant, and just lots of different stories. But it's really busy and really fun.
What's the vibe like, Dean, on Christmas Day and New Year's Day?
Two very different. Christmas Day is amazing. But Christmas Day has changed a lot also because people are out shopping now, returning guests. There's a lot more retail open. But yeah, you start out in the morning, there's your local breakfast crowd that comes in. And then by 10, 11 o'clock, it's just teeming with all sorts of people, whether, you know, they're tourists visiting the city, people in the neighborhood, people not working, people not shopping. So the brunch moves through till 5 o'clock. It's insane. And then we stay open till 8 o'clock for dinner, and we have a nice family-based type dinner. Mm. And the staff comes in. It's just a nice place for the community to come together on Christmas. New Year's Day is an absolute disaster. Getting open in the morning has its own challenges. Once you get open, you get all sorts coming in. And then surprisingly, by, you know, 2-3 o'clock, you get people that want to repeat their night before festivities, and it gets pretty wild.
People haven't gone to sleep at all night before.
Yeah. Or occasionally you walk in the morning, there's somebody lying on the banquette who didn't make it anywhere at all. But the holidays, the whole month, you know, moving from Thanksgiving all the way through till New Year's, the whole city feels this angst or joy or whatever you want to call it for the holidays. But you feel in a restaurant a lot of people coming in with shopping bags, people coming with family, friends, out-of-towners. So the whole energy just goes all the way through till this New Year's Eve night, and then brunch is like the last hurrah. And then on January 2nd, we pick up our pieces and start over again, looking forward to the next Christmas and New Year.
Well, before I let you go, let's talk about the cookbook.
Cool.
Does it have a lot of family recipes in it? What am I finding in the cookbook? You guys have put out your own.
It's all in the cookbook. Most of the menu is on the cookbook. All the recipes are there. And, I mean, my favorite part is the introduction, because there's a little story of how we even got here, because for us it's still a little miracle. And, you know, there's not a day that we don't go into work and think we realize it's all a miracle. So our story is there of where we came from, how we met, how we landed up in the city, and how we opened and got till the day we were publishing the book. And yeah, it was just a really fun process of putting all of that information together. All the recipes are there, little anecdotes about each dish, where it came from, so all the questions you had initially, and just pretty photos.
It feels like a place that is family.
It is.
It really feels like, and hearing you describe it seems like a place that is family.
You know, it's even deeper when you say family, because we worked in restaurants our whole life, and obviously I met mine in a restaurant. But the people you work with in a restaurant, they are closer than your family. They're your best friend, they're your worst friend, they're the people you hang out with, they're people you go away with. But it becomes this really stronghold. And once you have that kind of community inside the restaurant with your staff, for a customer to attach to it is very easy, because they feel the sense and they feel this joy that comes across from them. So inside all of that, I'm losing track of what I was saying, but inside all of that in the cookbook, it has to be a place that you feel yourself. You know, whether you mourn in something, whether you fell in love, whether something broke apart, you have to have a place you can go to and sit with it. And Jacques Soir Frites has certainly become a place for a lot of people, from the staff all the way through to the customers, that you can come inside and find this comfort. Whether you want to be alone, whether you want to be at the large party, whether you want to be late night, early morning, it's a cafe you can come hang at any time.
Dean and Maya, thanks for joining us on all of it.
Thank you, Alice.
Thank you.
Great.
That was great.